Today we have a guest, like a traditional guest, not like a special co-hosty guest like we've had in this season, but a real guest. You all right, Steve?
All right, mate. It's not me. I'm not the guest.
No, Steve.
Thanks for the lead in, though, to make it feel like I am the guest. So go ahead. This is fine. It's your show. Go ahead.
Yeah. Steve's usually here. He doesn't say, you probably ignore him, if I'm honest.
Hi, I'm Steve Rick.
And I'm Tim Elliott.
And welcome to the RE of Marketing podcast.
A podcast where we rethink, replay and remark on all good things to do with branding and marketing. Today's guest is a friend of mine, and I've known him for ages, I think, and his name's Ben Lumley. Ben Lumley, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hello. Yes, we have been friends for a while. It has been a very long time, to be fair.
It has been unusually long, I think.
Yeah, unusually. You make that sound like you don't keep friends for very long, like they've got a 2-year shelf life and then you just move them on.
Well, this is it. This is because we, in over that time, we've only met in real life like a few times. I think if it was the other way around...
Yeah, we'd have been sick of each other by now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a professional sports photographer. That's basically what I do. I'm very fortunate to be one of the ones who gets to travel around the world and do the thing they love for a living. And I've been doing it for about 4 years, launched a business 4 years ago. Which I'm sure we'll get onto later in the episode because it's quite an interesting story. And yeah, I've been really fortunate enough to work with some of the best athletes on the best stages in the best venues in the world. Was even awarded Sports Photographer of the Year, British Sports Photography Awards last year, 2020, Ooh. Which is slightly ironic, actually, when you win this big prestigious award and it's really, really cool and you think it's the height of what I'll ever do. This is brilliant. Bring the trophy home, you put it on the desk, it looks ace, you go and fly away for a 4 days work in Northern Italy, and then COVID hits, and then you're the sports photographer of the year for the year where sport didn't happen.
Excellent.
Well, and I say it's probably the other way around now, isn't it, Ben? It's probably people need those pictures more now that happening. So you've probably done it in the right year.
I probably have done it in the right year. There's definitely demand for stuff. It was just a bit weird. Like, I'll always have that slight tinge of irony that, yes, I won the award in the year where sport didn't exist for 9 months.
Yeah, you'll be all right. They'll get the name changed on the bottom of it to COVID year rather than 2020.
It's a black award with, like, embossed writing on it. So I'm just going to grab a Tippex pen, I think, and scratch that zero out and put it on as a one.
You could spin it in a creative way and just say, I won this award because I took 90% of the live sport photography that year.
Yeah, I was one of the only photographers who worked all year, and that's why I won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was the best by far and stuff, you can say. But that'd be amazing. But apart from that, which we will get onto, the photography angle, because I want to talk about visual communication and the fact that storytelling and communication is, I can't remember the exact stat, but like 93-95% visual compared to written. But you are technically a reformed or a recovering agency guy, right? When I met you, I don't know which the right vernacular is, but reformed or recovering.
Yeah, so when we met way back in the day, I was a web designer and web developer, and I worked for a web company based in North Notts. And I was building and designing websites for a living, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday kind of thing. So I've always had, when I launched the business and when I started this journey off, I always had like a commercial awareness. Like I remember really, I shouldn't remember it fondly because it probably was awful at the time, but we had a client come up, we were doing a big website. She'd had a £5,500 fashion photo shoot done for her fashion website that we were making. And the photos look beautiful. She sat down by my desk, we're going through everything. I'm like, I can't use any of these. She's like, why not? I was like, because they're all portrait and I need big landscape photos for your website because we live in a landscape device world. So she literally had to bin £5,500 worth of photo shoot because the images just went right. So like I've always had that commercial awareness of what's going to look good on a banner, what's going to look good on a website, what's going to kind of look good on a Instagram grid and what will, you know, what's going to crop nicely, what's not going to crop nicely. So yeah, I have that agency, web, media, social marketing, whatever you want to call it these days, kind of background, I guess. I was very, 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 I still am in a way, but I was very into Gary Vaynerchuk for a long time. So like, I remember very fondly watching his big first keynote. I think it was the Web 2.0 Summit keynote, like the really big one.
Yeah.
That really launched him, and I was like right on the cusp of his stuff then. And so I've been like really into that kind of web world, marketing world, creativity world for quite a while, even before I started the business. So it's very intertwined in what I do.
Yeah, I can imagine. I remember early Gary V was very good. Like some of I've got a list in YouTube called a swipe file, and where I save every video I really like, yeah. I want to refer to. And all he's got a couple in there, actually.
Yeah. There's some absolute crackers. And I remember him saying once, like, his big objective is for actually to get people to unsubscribe from him and stop following him, because he wants people just to take the messages that he gives and just crack on and then not have to keep coming back. Like, he doesn't want to have to motivate people all the time.
Yeah.
And for ages, I was like, no, I will always be a diehard Gary Vee fan. And then actually in the last sort of 12 months, I've actually unfollowed him and unsubscribed from stuff, because the story is still the same and it's brilliant and it's bang on point for a lot of people. But like, I've got to that point now where I don't need it anymore. Like, I know where I am and where I'm going and what I'm doing, and I know how to do it. And, you know, I'll occasionally drop in just because I like to see how he's getting on and what he's doing and stuff. But yeah, like, he was I've read all his books. Like, I read his books within the first week of them coming out when they get released. It's that kind of,
yeah. Actually, his books are pretty good.
His books are pretty good. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he didn't write them.
He audio does them. So So like, he has ideas for them, and then he basically goes in the studio and rants, and then someone types it.
That's how he produces all his content. So talking about Gary Vee, Ben, like, and the fact that he, like, his message is just kind of just get out and do it, right? Like, make it, like, take action, stop thinking about it, push play, you know, like all that sort of thing. Was he mm-hmm. part of the decision?
Yep. Was Gary Vee part of the decision? That's a tough one, really.
Or was it just the right time?
No. It would have been an influence towards it, surely.
It 100% an influence. But like 90% of people who listen to stuff like Gary and Tim Ferriss and Chase Jarvis and all that kind of stuff, it's just motivational porn. It's just listen to it. It sounds amazing, but you do nothing with it.
Yeah.
And for a long time, I did nothing with it. Like, I was in that world for a long time, just listening and watching, and never pushed that button, never did anything with it. And I think the biggest pressure, I would say, that led to the decision wasn't Gary or Tim Ferriss or, you know, Chase Jarvis or anyone like that. What it actually was I was 35, about to turn 36. I know, I look a lot younger, don't I? And I knew that I was heading pretty quickly to my 40th birthday, which is in 6 weeks' time. And I had this ticking time bomb in me, if you want to call it that, that, like, if I didn't do something soon, I was going to hit 40 and I would be okay. And I didn't want to be okay. Like, I'd always had these dreams and ambitions to do something really cool. And like, photography was this big itch that I wanted to scratch. And ever since I picked a camera up, I knew that I wanted to do something with it that was good. And I just knew I was staring down the barrel of 40 and it was coming quick. And if I didn't do anything about it, if I didn't start now, I was gonna be sat behind a computer desk at 40, whether in the same company or with somebody else, and working for somebody else and be doing exactly the same things that I'd always done. And that was a huge deterrent, if you will, for me to go, I'm done. Absolutely done. and this is like, if I don't do it now, I'm going to run out of time. And I didn't want to get to 60, 65 and just think, oh man, do you know, if I'd just given it a crack. And don't get me wrong, like, I started that business, no money, no savings, no client base. It's always good when you start a business. Literally nothing. And it was terrifying. And I didn't 100% know it was going to be successful. I didn't know whether I could get the clients in that I wanted to work with to get it to do the thing that I wanted it to do as a business and as a lifestyle. And then fast forward 4 years, the things just exploded. It's ended in, as a business, it's ended in places I never thought it would go. And yeah, like, I hit 40 in 6 weeks time, and I honestly can, and I'm not particularly someone who sits there and I'll brag about how amazing and stuff I am. I let other people do that for me usually, and I get quite uncomfortable about it when people do it. But like, I know in 6 weeks time, when I wake up on my birthday, I'm going to go, do you know what? I'm actually really proud of where I've got to, you know, and forget the awards and forget the client base that I have and the people that I work with and where I've traveled and all that kind of stuff. I know I can look at 10 images in my portfolio that I am immensely proud of. And if the day after my birthday, I decide to hang my cameras up, then I will be immensely proud to the day I die for what I've achieved in the last 4 years. So really, all the Gary and Tim and Chase content that I used to just consume, I think it just put a really solid foundation in, and it became the voice in the back of my head, that little voice of reason that while I was making those decisions, it was that rhetoric that was in my head, rather than thinking, well, Gary Vaynerchuk's told me I should just do it. And so I'm going to do it. It was just like, that was all of that stuff was just in my subconscious. And it was the rhetoric that was constantly in my head all the time. And yeah, it probably paid to the decision, but the biggest determining factor was me just racing towards 40 and thinking, crikey, if I don't do something soon, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I joke with family and friends that like, most guys have a midlife crisis at about 40, grow a ponytail, unlike you, Tim, and then like get a sports car and date a 21-year-old and all those crazy things. Whereas I just decided to start a business out of nowhere. So that was my midlife crisis, really.
So wait till you actually hit 40 and the midlife crisis does come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the worrying thing now, is what's going to happen on my birthday. I'm going to be like, oh, actually, I want to go and travel the world in nothing but flip-flops and a pair of shorts.
Do work you're proud of, right? Because the amount of time you have to spend doing work, right? Like, do work you're proud of. Because I've been like Ben, I was in agency world before going out on my own, and like, I've been doing, in theory, marketing roles, right from, you know, marketing for nightclubs when I was a late teen, right, mm-hmm. to proper marketing, not just drinking for free. Like for ages, but like the amount of stuff, like Ben's 10 photos that I could put in a portfolio and go, love that, right? It's pretty small for that amount of time, right? It's just work, like client work, and clients were happy with it. And I did what I was told, and then bought a bit of, you know, additional creativity and love towards it, but I'm not putting them in a portfolio. I don't have a portfolio, right? And I don't know, I think having that portfolio, that pride, is something creative people across the board should have, a portfolio of the work, right? It's inherent with our lifestyle, right? Do you reckon, Ben? Or
yeah, no, I do. Like, I have a lot of, it sounds really weird saying this out loud, because I feel like I'm them, but like, I have a lot of up and coming photographers who'll message me Twitter and Instagram or email and stuff, and they'll always like ask advice, like, what should I do? And I still feel like I'm up and coming, like I'm only 4 years into this, like I'm no 20-year veteran. But like, my advice is always like, follow the joy, don't follow the money, because everyone's like, oh, I can't make enough money. Right, well, stop trying to make money out of it. Like, if you're chasing money down trying to do this, then it's going to take all the joy, all the happiness, all the creativity out of it, and like, you won't get that pride. Because, yeah, it's great to you know, get a 4-5 figure invoice, you know, land and get paid, that's brilliant. But if it doesn't make you happy, like, what's literally, what's the point? And I would do what I do for free if I didn't have to worry about money and bills and, you know, car payments and rent and all that jazz. My kids didn't want Christmas presents, then I'd do it for free. But because I love what I do that much, and I'm one of the lucky ones who's found that in life, and I appreciate that not everybody has that, and not everybody has the courage to go and find that. But, like, I think for those of us who are lucky enough to do it, that pride in what you do is just huge. And it then stops becoming about the money. It stops becoming about, like, having to work with this client because you need to work with this client. It's the absolute crap. Like, I fire clients all the time. They don't know about it. I just, next time they ask me for some work, I go, I'm sorry, I'm really busy. But, like, why we, like you say, work is such an integral part of what we do, whether that's Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, whether that's like me, 10 a.m. till 11 p.m., 12 p.m. on a Sunday, depending on what it is. Like, it's irrelevant. Like, it's the thing that dominates what you do. And if you don't love it, then I don't really see the point in doing it. Just change to something else. And we get, as a species, we get stuck in this rhetoric of, well, my parents want me to be responsible, and, you know, I need to get a decent paying job, and I need to have this car, and I need to live in this kind of house. And it's just crap. Go and do the thing you want to do, and if you do it with enough love and enough passion, the money will just flow. And if you're anything like me, you'll sit there and shake your head 9 times out of 10 and go, why is anyone paying me for this? Because this is brilliant and I do it for free. And it's like, why are they paying me all this money? It's brilliant.
I had this conversation today with one of my customers. They're getting a little bit closer to retirement age. And they were talking about pensions and how, you know, they're self-employed and they don't have a pension pot. And they were going, it's slightly worrying. I'm like, yeah, I can understand why that's slightly worrying. But do you wish 30 or 40 years ago when you'd started what you're doing now that... you've done something different, or have you enjoyed the last 30 or 40 years and you've still got another 10 years left? It's not as if it's on the doorstep. He just said, no, I wouldn't have changed what I've done for the world. And I said, well, that's a better form of wealth than having money.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
You know, we being able to sit there and go, I'm happy with what I've done in life. Yeah. I mean, no money would ever buy that.
No. I don't want to sit in my nursing home or wherever I end up when I'm very old and be like, oh, well, I made loads of money. I'd rather sit there and, like, tell all the nursing staff that I worked with Nike for a few years. That was pretty cool. And, you know, flew to Japan. That was pretty... I'd rather have that story to tell than go, well, I made this... This invoice number 216 was £500, and it was amazing. It's like, just... We have this attachment to money.
Yeah.
Like, earning vast amounts of money. And it's just... It just isn't necessary for a lot of people. And ironically, I earn more money now not caring about money, doing what I love, than I've ever done when I've tried to chase that bloody thing. It's like chasing a cat. You can't chase it. You just leg it and run off.
See, that's exactly what happened. I was going to bring up, actually, when we're on about the 40th or the 40th year.
Can I just point out as well, like, I'm not all doom and gloom. Like, I'm not thinking, oh, I'm going to get to 40 and my life's over. It just was this random number in my head that I was just like, if I don't do something, I'm going to do it. I don't want all your listeners to be like, wow, he's got real complex about it, getting older. And like, honestly, I don't care.
I think
it's this real milestone for me.
There's that point, though, no matter whether it's an age thing or a time thing, or like there's some circumstance that I think everybody gets to a point where they go, well, it's now or never, whatever that's for.
Yep.
And a bunch of people, and it's a choice, right? It's either, I don't do it, or yes, I will, right? And I think whatever that you know, tipping point is, right? I think we all have one.
I'm going to throw something in there. I think we all actually get to that tipping point and are willing to cross it. I think it's the support system around you that stops you from crossing the tipping point quite often.
I think it's the support system around you that will often stop you, but also your perception of their opinions.
Yeah.
Like,
I love my dad's bits. He's a huge role model in my life, but I was terrified telling him that I basically had left full-time work and I was launching a business. Absolutely terrified of telling him that. And his response was, you should have done it sooner. Like, and we have these expectations of what our support system is going to be like when we get to that tipping point. And 9 times out of 10, they just want us to be happy. And you'll always get the mum or, you know, the big brother or whatever who's like, oh, yeah, you should play safe and do this and do that. But, you know, most of it's our expectations in our head of what we think they're going to be like that stops us. And it stops us before we ever approach the subject with them to say, actually, I want to do this, this and this. Because I think from my experience, from what I've seen of other creatives, is that actually that support system is very supportive once they understand it and once they see it. But we tell ourselves these stories that, oh God, my mum's going to be mad. And actually mum doesn't really care. She just wants you to be happy.
I think that's the thing though, isn't it? As creatives, we're not actually very good at putting things across to people. Sometimes.
No, we're not.
We're dreadful at it.
No, that's why creatives should not have a 30-second elevator pitch, because it isn't 30 seconds, it's 6 hours. It's a walk and a talk and many cups of coffee. Like, the creative elevator pitch is not 30 seconds long.
No. But you know at the end of that cup of coffee or the end of that 6-hour walk that person's completely bought into that.
Exactly.
Person.
Yeah.
Because we're brilliant at getting people on side eventually. We're just not very good at doing it in,
An instant.
30 seconds, like you said.
I remember having a sales job once and I lasted a month because they basically wanted us to either knock on doors, physically knock on doors to sell broadband and telephone services, or to ring up people. It was B2B. And no one cared. No one wanted us. And I could never ever grasp it. I couldn't get that initial 30 seconds to a minute, like get the conversation going. But now, like, I can talk about my work, how I work with clients, sort of stuff I do, what my work brings to a big multinational client, like the benefits, all that. I can do that for flipping ages and they'll go, yeah, awesome, sign. But like, you get me to sell a product over the phone or in person, if it's not me, I can't do it. Like, and I think it is like those creatives like us just can't do it in 30 seconds. This 30 seconds elevator pitch is just a complete load of rubbish. We need many cups of coffee, 6 hours, lots of email conversations, like lots of general relationship building. And that's why I've done well. I think when I look at why I've done well from a marketing point of view, I did air quotes for those people who are listening. That's probably, it's a lost art form, isn't it, when it's on the podcast? But like, that's why I've done well with marketing, because it isn't, because I don't market myself. I build relationships with lots and lots of people, and I build relationships with people that I think will not only just be good relationships to have within that sport, within that business, within that, you know, sector, whatever it is, but also ones that I know that are going to probably kick on and do something else. Like, I'm always thinking, I'm never like, oh yeah, that they seem really, really cool. I'm thinking, well, that person seems really, really cool. And I get on really, really well with them. And they're the CEO of X, or, you know, they do B, and that could get me into this, and that could get me into that. Like, there's always like this map in my head of where potential relationships and potential clients and working with potential individuals can take me. Relationship building is just, that's my marketing. It always has been.
That's exactly,
and showing off pretty pictures. That's like, yeah, look at this, and then lots of people go, yeah, we'll buy you. Yeah.
And you take a decent picture, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
But
because I've got a big fancy camera, and it makes it quite easy to take nice pictures.
But it's like, it's that. Oh God, like we said, we launched this podcast in September 2019, right? So a bit into lockdown. But we were recording a couple of months earlier than that, so like the first third of lockdown. And we were saying, right, the things that are going to get last for businesses till the end, to the other side of this thing, which we thought, I think at that time, was going to be like 3 months or 6 months or something ridiculous, right? Is business relationship, right? The deeper and the better your relationships.
Yep, 100%. Right?
That's the only thing that will survive any fuck up in service, any customer service error, any default, any pandemic, anything. Agreed. Right?
I had, like, I went through, so to tell my COVID story, went to the Savoy Hotel, won a big award, brilliant.
Yep.
Came home the following day, boarded a plane, flew to Italy for 4 days, Northern Italy, winter triathlon championships in the snow, brilliant. then COVID started hitting and getting really serious. This was like very, very early February. Came home, did a few bits and pieces, was watching stuff kind of like get shuffled around in the calendar and was like, okay, well, something's obviously going to like, we're going to have a bit of a prolonged bump here where we're having to deal with stuff. April hit, nothing. Everything got wiped out of the calendar. I lost about 25 grand's worth of work in the end last year in total. Nothing for April, nothing for May, nothing for June, nothing for July. A large portion of August, nothing happened. And I was like, and I had very limited contact with a lot of my business relationships because they were fighting fires. They were being furloughed. They had enough other stuff to deal with without me going, oh, have you got any work? Because it just wouldn't do anything. But the ones, interestingly, over the last sort of 6 months, so the back end of last year, early this year, the clients that I've got lots more work out of are the ones who really quickly in August, September came back and started building the relationship again and started like touching base. Those ones that have still remained distant are a little bit still on the fringes, but like those really good relationships that I built in 2019, early 2020 are the ones that have just kept me afloat now, basically from September, October, all the way through to present day. And those business relationships, I think, is what's kept a lot of businesses in business. The ones that have got crappy business relationships are the ones that have just disappeared off the map. Yeah,
the ones that were very transactional and all about the sale, right?
Transactional is like my absolute favorite word. I often have clients who say to me, oh, are you sure that's how much you want to quote? Because I assume it's not enough. They expect it to be more. And I'm like, well, if I was running a very transactional business, i.e. I want a piece of work from you, you're going to pay a lot of money for it and that's it, then we go our separate ways. My approach to business would be very, very different, but I don't want that. What I want is to be like I am, the England netball photographer, the guy that England netball will call, whether they've got an international series, whether they've got Commonwealth Games coming up next year, whether we've got like a Super League season behind closed doors, where they're not allowing no media and no photographers in at all. I want to be the guy, and that, thankfully I am now, the person that they come to and go, right, this is what we're doing, so we need photos, you're the person who's going to do it. You know, I want to have a long-standing relationship with clients. I want, you know, International Triathlon Union to be constantly feeding me work, which is they did in 2019. It was brilliant. And when we get the calendar back this year, fingers crossed, you know, we'll be back on that. Same with rugby. Like, I'm building some really good rugby contacts at the minute, and I want those elongated relationships. I don't want like it's £400 for a 45-minute game of football. You know, I'll cover the first half, 45 minutes, and I'll do it for 400 quid, and that's just a one-off transaction. I don't want that. That's not what I want. What I want is a long-standing relationship that becomes much, much bigger. Because I can go, it's like I do a lot of stuff with like athletes, professional athletes and stuff. And sometimes, especially starting off, I was like, they were like, oh, you know, I'd love to do some photos with you, but can't afford you. I was like, right, well, we'll do it for free. Like, I don't care. Let's just do it free. Because I would rather build a relationship with an athlete and then all the brands that sponsor them than go, right, well, it's 100 quid for my time. And then they'll use me once because they can only afford to use me once. But actually, if you build that relationship, their sponsors come on. You can then turn what potentially could have been 100 quid for, you know, 45 minutes to an hour photo shoot. You can turn that into 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 grand when their bike sponsor comes online or their trainer sponsor comes online and goes, right, well, we've got this big photo shoot. Like, that's how I've started all of my new sports and working with new people. Just like, get the feelers out, see what's happening, and then start leveraging the money like further down the line. Like, I started working in netball. I did it for free for the first couple of games because I was trying to find my footing and see what worked. And then like October last year, in the middle of a pandemic, England netball were like, right, so we're going to do a photo shoot with Nike. So you need to be, you're going to basically be photo shooting, doing a photo shoot for Nike, for us. And it was huge. As a commercial project for me, it was massive, big payout, lots. It was brilliant. That wouldn't have happened if I'd have gone, stepped into that new sport and gone, right, well, it's this straight away. Once you remove the transactional element away from a business, from a creative business, and you start looking at a bigger relationship, it becomes a much, much bigger thing. Because if it's just out for the money, people like pick that up really, really quickly.
Yeah. And I think, like, obviously I follow you, I see a bunch of your story on Instagram.
Right? A bunch of my crap is what you were going to say to me.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It was definitely story. But a bunch of your story on Instagram. But also, like, even me, who I'm not connected with England netball or netball in any way, right? At all. Like I only view it through your Instagram feed, right? But even I recognize the players now, right? I see that relationship, like some of them are like, I can't remember who they are or anything, I just look at the pictures, but I was going, oh, they're doing a single shoot now, like a product shoot, but I recognize them from one of the teams, right? Just the colors of the shirts, right? Jesus. But like, it's that longevity, right? It's not like the next time somebody's taking a photo of that team, it's somebody else with a different style, a different filter on the camera, a different perspective, right? It's you, and it builds that, I'm going to use marketing terms, but it builds that attribution, that brand value of that team, of that player, of that thing up through 100%. Continuity, right? But is that, I don't know, is that on purpose for you? It's like doing the, you know, the behind the scenes Instagram-y stuff. Is that part of why people choose you? Is that just for you? What's their thinking around that? Did they play? Because some of those photos are, you know, not being a photographer, like obscure angles. Like you've been doing a bunch from above.
Most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. Don't like heights. 16 meters up above some of the best athletes in the country. Yeah, it's not very fun, but it's worth it for the output.
But it's that. You know, how much I'm interested in the creative process behind telling that story, because you'll know that you'll be like Loughborough down the road from us, theoretically, is one of the teams you photograph a lot, and you know, there's a story of that. How, with that business relationship in mind, how far ahead do you plan, like how interconnected are the shoots? I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, no, you are. Okay, so right, so we've just started Super League season 2021, all behind closed doors, because we've got the go ahead for Pro Elite Sport. It's good. I actually am not, I've got two objectives in mind from a business point of view, from a cold hearted, and we've just argued against using this word, transactional point of view.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do two things. I've got two business objectives. One, to provide netball as a sport with the images that I know it deserves, which it's not had for the last, well, especially 2-3 years since I've been around in the world. Like, it deserves that very glossy, very high quality, very creative, very arty, very cool action sports photos. It doesn't need boring action shots that you can get from, you know, any sports photographer anywhere in the world. It deserves something really special. So that's one of my big business aims, to help that sport as a whole grow and develop. So all of my work at the moment, and it's been the same with Loughborough Lightning as a franchise, because I've worked with them for the last 2 years, you know, that's all been about like just trying to like raise the image quality of the sport. I remember when I first started, I sat down with the director of netball, Sarah Bayman, for Loughborough Lightning, and I said, like, one of the reasons that I want to get into the sport is because the image quality and the image profile isn't great, and I feel I can offer something really special. And I think the quality of output that the sport has, grassroots, professional level, international level, just needs to get lifted massively. So that's been a big business goal for me, and that's what one of my objectives. My other objective, incredibly selfishly, is we have a Commonwealth Games coming up, Birmingham 2022, and I want to be on the sideline for that. Like, I want to be there, whether that's doing it for the Commonwealth Games themselves, whether that's just primary shooting for England netball, whether that's covering it for an agency. Like, I want to have demonstrated enough over the last 2 or 3 years that someone gives me an opportunity to go to a major games. Same with triathlon. Like, I've put a lot of work in with triathlon over the last couple of years. Obviously, we haven't done anything for the last 12 months. But the ultimate goal is to get to an Olympic Games, to get to a Commonwealth Games. It's, you know, it's to get to those big stage events where I can really apply my trade. And that's the cold, hard truth of it. So all of my stuff in a way, netball's a good example because it is all interconnected, because I'm trying to not only get myself to the very, very top as I can possibly go, but also just to raise that image profile of the game.
But it's interesting, right? Because the way I see it is that you're involved in building the brand around England netball, right? Yep. You're visually telling that story, but it seems to me, like from the outside, from what you're just saying, that your goals are aligned, because the people in England netball and the players in England netball want to perform on the biggest stages, right? They want to be at the Commonwealth Games and the Olympics, which is exactly what you want.
Yep. So England netball, currently the Commonwealth gold medalist from 2018. Yeah, Gold Coast 2018. So like when it comes back to Birmingham in 18 months time, like they need to be on the cusp of it. And I remember being in a big England netball staff conference last year, and they were pitching how they wanted to basically lay out the next 5 years of the plan, so to speak. I just walked away thinking, like, I'm in the right place at the right time. Everything's aligning. Like, this could be really special. And that's why I do what I do. It's the same with triathlon. It's the same with rugby. Like, rugby doesn't have beautiful, amazing photos. Like, it occasionally will come out, but I just know there's more scope in both men's and women's rugby at the professional level to really do something special. And I don't see it quite yet. There's a few guys and girls who do some really good stuff, but it's not enough mainstream good quality images coming out of rugby. Same for me there. That's why I want to go into rugby. It's because I just know that I can do something a bit special.
It's kind of nice, though, because what you're doing is you're documenting passion more than anything else.
Yeah.
And it, you know, so I always think back to good photography in sports. And the one that always comes into my head is Michael Jordan Duncan.
Yep.
In the white jersey, number 23 on.
Yep.
And then the other ones that I always remember is Bradley Wiggins doing the 2012 tour and winning on the finish line with Chris Froome behind him.
Yep.
You know, and they're beautifully shot. Mm-hmm. They're things that you want to own. It's actually funny, I got given the Bradley Wiggins photography book the other week, the One I Won book, which is just 2012 documented through pictures.
Yeah.
And it is stunning. And I've sat and read that for hours. Well, read it, looked at it for hours. There's nothing to read, really.
But how many stories are in there just from those images?
And it's unbelievable.
If you didn't watch it live, where like the rest of us, like even if you were totally removed, you could still tell yourself all those stories just by looking at those pictures.
Yeah, and every sport does deserve that.
Yeah.
You're completely right. It doesn't matter if it's archery or if it's netball or if it's, I don't know, well, Skittles, whatever it is. You know, there's a lot of people dedicate a lot of time to that type of thing to get the best that they can be, to go to the Olympics, to go and win a gold medal. And for some of those sports not to have as much or as good photography or as good video covering it, then it's not fair on them.
No. And it does make a huge difference these days as well, because there's so much competition for eyeballs in media. Like, if you don't have great content coming out, you do start to slip away from the rest of the pack. Yeah. And like, it does get really, really difficult. One of the biggest things for me and my work, so I'm a big Darren Heath fan. Darren Heath is a Formula One photographer. He's probably one of the best Formula One photographers in the world. There's a couple of really stunning photographers out there, but like, he's absolutely there. And his ethos is always, I watched a video about him where he was talking about his kind of his craft and how he works. And like, he's always pushing to try and create stuff that can be framed. Like, he's trying to create an image that doesn't just look good on a website or an Instagram feed, but that you can blow up to like A0 poster print and frame it in beautiful glass and have it as part of an exhibition. And like, that's ultimately where I want to be. Like, the reason I want to be at a Commonwealth Games and Olympic Games and world finals for this and world finals for that, and why I want to be at Twickenham for a Six Nations and all those kind of things, is because I know that those images are the ones that, when I hit 65, 70, something like that, and I'm lucky enough to get a gallery showing somewhere, like, those are the ones that I'll be able to show off. Like, that's the quality of work. And I want people to be able to walk into something like that and just be blown away. And it not just be like, oh yeah, that's a cool photo of that goal or that try or whatever, but just to be have their jaw dropped because of the quality of what's in front of them as a piece of art. And that's kind of where I differentiate myself from a lot of sports photography work for agency, whether that's kind of Associated Press or Getty or Reuters or whoever, who are there just to capture that goal or that try or that wicket or whatever. Like, I'm trying to create a piece of art every time I'm going out. I'm trying to see if I can create something really special that maybe one day in a far off world could get framed and shown to a gallery somewhere.
There's been loads of official brain science people like studying humans' brains when, like, for stimulation in regarding to different kinds of forms of media and stuff, and story, for example, is one of the ones that affects the brain emotionally in the logical bit and somatically, right? So somatically is the physical reaction, so goosebumps, smile, laugh, cry, frown, etc., etc., right? But as you two were talking about doing the piece of work, the art piece, right? Having that this might be the thing that gets stuck on a wall in a gallery, piece of like mindset behind all of the work. I was thinking about sports images I remember. And I remember my dad was always a runner. He's not a runner now, he's 83. But, you know, he's still...
It's like in a Benny Hill way, he just runs away from the nurse.
Yeah. But he's been always into it, right? We were lucky to grow up watching the Olympics when there was people like Michael Johnson, right, who was just ridiculous, and Roger Black, who was perennially second because he's never going to win, right?
Yeah. With
Michael Johnson on the pitch, what a sucker of a career that is. But but those world record images with, you know, the ones where you're, I don't know what the right term is, pitch side, but for the crowd, they're behind and there's loads of flashes from the people. Yep. And there's Jesus, that still makes me a bit goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure
I don't shoot weddings. I will say this now. I shoot weddings by request. So there's a few elite athletes, professional athletes that have asked me in the past, and I've got a couple coming up this year where they're like, look, we love your stuff so much, we love working with you, please come and shoot our wedding. I was like, right, okay, whatever. But I won't advertise it. I don't enjoy shooting weddings particularly unless it's for people I know. But I fundamentally believe, like, if you're a wedding photographer, like, if you don't make the bride cry when you hand your photos back, you've done something wrong. Like, photos should elicit that emotional response out of somebody.
My wife cried when she got hers back, but that's because of the cost of them.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, they're not cheap either. Like, everyone's like, oh, you should make more money, go and do weddings. No, God, no.
No.
There are some seriously costly wedding photographers out there.
Ridiculous. But yeah,
like, photos should do that. They should invoke a memory or an emotion or give you goosebumps. Or, you know, I can still very fondly remember the first ever photographic print I ever had. It was my uncle was an amateur photographer, still is, and he took a photo of a motocross bike at a local championship course that we had not far from where I grew up. And I still remember it, A3, black and white, number 63 on the front of the bike. And, you know, if I saw it now, I'd probably be like, oh, it's not technically the best photo in the world, but like, it stuck with me so much that, you know, that's what photography should do. And that's what I do. Like, we're 2 weeks in Super League now for this season. And I know I've already got like one or two photos probably that I think will stand the test of time just for really solid netball photos. And I think that for me is exciting, far more exciting than, you know, when a client goes, yeah, we'll pay that quote, you know, we'll hire you. That's less exciting than me getting something really, really special. Like, I went to Doha for the World Beach Games, October 2019. And I had some beautiful, because we were running the triathlon 4 o'clock in the morning because the heat during the day was too hot. So we needed to do it like super in the morning, as soon as the sun came up, to keep the temperatures down for the athletes. And just some of the sunrise stuff I was getting of swimmers entering the water in the bay just to kind of start warming up and all that. Just, you're never going to get those photos normally. And just to get that kind of special image means way more than me, more to me, than, you know, when that client then pays the invoice at the end of the thing. It's like, that's secondary, you know, being able to go, that's a cracker of an image, even for me with my high standards, that's more important.
When you're taking that image, Ben, are you taking it for the people that are there doing it, or are you taking it for the other people that are there watching? So, in COVID, it's going to be a lot harder because you haven't got audiences there watching, you know, the netball or the rugby or what have you.
But again, that's still a story to tell, like the year when we had no spectators. Yeah.
So I was just thinking when Tim was talking about the Olympic stuff, and, you know, there's that great picture of Jessica Ennis-Hill when she wins a gold medal with her arms above her head. And you automatically go back to that. Oh, I remember Super Saturday. I remember how exciting it was. I remember watching the long jump, then moving into Jessica, then going on to Mo after. And you remember the mobile, and it just incites everything, doesn't it? You start to relive it.
Yeah.
Whereas, because people aren't there at the moment, I know it's telling a different story. It's telling a year of COVID sport in the year of COVID, but do you have to change the way that you take your photography at that point because there is nobody else there to react to it? Are you trying to tell a slightly different story?
Yes and no. So I did some cricket stuff for Loughborough Lightning September, October time last year, and we were at Trent Bridge, completely empty. It was just two teams, a couple of photographers and officials. And the story of having a massive empty Trent Bridge with, you know, professional level cricket going on in the centre square, like, that's a story to tell.
Yeah.
But for the majority, what I'm trying to do is just create stuff that just makes people scrolling through Instagram or Twitter go, holy crap, and stop for 30 seconds. Because as a species nowadays, we're really good at just scrolling aimlessly. And I've always wanted to stop people. And whether that's in an empty arena, an empty stadium, or whether it's chock packed full, it doesn't actually enter my brain, I don't think, at that point. I struggled quite a bit in the first couple of years of doing this, where I was like, where does this kind of weird gift that I have come from? Because I'm not thinking particularly when I'm working. There's no like, well, so this person's running towards me at 10 miles an hour, and so I need to be at a thousandth of a second shutter speed, and my ISO needs to be, I'm never thinking that, absolutely not. I'm just kind of like, it's always a flow state thing for me, always. It's always done on feel. It's always just let what's happening in front of me happen. And I'll be thinking about, I need to get that sponsor logo in because that's on my brief for this client. Like, I need to nail this. Or, you know, sometimes we'll be like, oh, can we get a partner shot of such and such? So, right, you think, okay, well, I need to get that logo in, so let's do something a bit special, and, you know, all that kind of jazz. But I don't tend to think too much when I'm working. I just kind of let it go. The more I think about what I'm trying to do, the more I tend to kind of get stuck. Whereas if I just let it go and just follow what's happening, then generally that's what I get more out of, I think.
Natural ability.
Yeah. It's a weird one. I'd love to be able to sit there and go, so, right, this is my thought process for this photo here. I couldn't tell you. It's literally, oh, that's happening in front of me. Right, okay, bang, 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 done. And then it moves on. And I've got, it's so ingrained my way of working now that I can't, it's really hard for me to explain it. I tend to, my primary goal, I think, when I'm always taking photos, aside from client X wanting a picture of this logo or that player or this athlete or whatever, is always then, right, what's the best way that I can show it off? What's the nicest way that I can make this look cool? And I'd rather be creative and different, and clients hire me because of that. And I'd rather be that because, okay, so grand finals for, let's skip back a couple of weeks. Olympic test event 2019 August. We are in Japan for triathlon. We're out there, World Triathlons, four or five photographers for ITU, and there's probably 50 in the stadium, in the stands behind us. And it's the women's race. Jess Learmon and George Taylor Brown cross the line holding hands. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole uproar across the media. You probably saw it in the news that they get disqualified. They were 1 and 2, cross the line holding hands, get disqualified because they break a rule, blah, 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 blah. There is 50 images of exactly the same thing, but the ITU hire the 4 or 5 of us, International Triathlon Union, hire the 4 or 5 photographers they have because they don't want the 50 exactly the same photos that they've got from the press pen behind them. They want loads of different stuff. They want different angles of that moment. They want different kind of levels of creativity of that moment. So we've got guys behind the line. We've got me in front of the line. I'm kind of shooting through the tape itself. We've got a guy up in the stand shooting down and going wide. And, you know, they want that creativity, and that's what clients hire me for. And that's why I've always tried to go down that route, because it's just, you know, I could go to Olympic Games in Paris in 2024, and, you know, 100 meter finals for men, there's going to be 100 photos. They're all going to be the same. And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that person. I want to be the person who's got a different angle, shows it from a different way, still the same result, still the same person winning, but it's just done a little bit differently.
What? So for the people listening, right? So the creative folks listening, whether or not you're a photographer, I think there's stuff that you can take away from how you work and how you think and for want of a nicer word, the process for it. So what would you say, in your opinion, either using you as an example or just your general knowledge, what are the foundations or the building blocks of doing best creative work, like stuff you're proud of? What has to be in place, would you say?
So I think it's better for me, for my stuff, like I would much rather, I need to take my time. Like I need to know what people expect of me. So I need to know what a client wants. If I have no idea what a client wants because they haven't communicated with me, because we've not had that conversation, it becomes very difficult to produce something that they like at the end of it. But then once I've got that information, like I need the time and I need the freedom to work. So like, yesterday we had 2 games. Last night for Super League, I was at the venue 3 hours beforehand, and for the first hour I just sat on the side of the court and I just looked. No one was in there. PA guys were testing audio levels and stuff, but I literally just sat there and I just took it all in, and it just gives me the time to think, and that might be a nice angle and that might look quite nice, and or maybe I could try this. And you know, if I rush my workflow, if I rush my creative workflow and I'm like racing here and racing there, like I never get it. So actually I found, and I know from my experience in the sports that I work in, I have got an awful lot more time than I think I have. Rugby is a great example. Like I could sit behind a try line and photograph every single piece of action that's coming towards me and get that try. And yes, getting that try photo is brilliant, because that's the one that social media ends up using somewhere. But I know if I take my time and I try different angles and different places around the pitch, that I can get something a little bit more special, which has a little bit more traction socially for brands and sponsors and all that kind of stuff. And you know, if you miss a try or you miss a goal or whatever, then so be it. But if you've still got a stack of 30 really, really solid images out of it, then it doesn't particularly matter. But my personal creative workflow is time, and I need freedom and time to think and go through that and soak it all in. And, you know, putting me in one place is never a good thing. Like I don't sit still. Like I think I've racked up on average about 17,000-18,000 steps on Super League days. And we're just in essentially a big arena, big empty arena with a netball court on it, and I'm still doing like nearly 20,000 steps, just walking around, changing locations, going up in the roof, going up on a balcony, going behind the bench, all that kind of stuff. It's just, for me, it's mixing it up and taking the time to see stuff. You know, yeah, I could sit and fire 30,000 images off per game, but I'm never going to deliver them. I'm only ever going to deliver 50 to 100 per match. So take my time and use that time effectively to really make those 50 to 100 images that I give back really good.
Yeah, I think, you know, that echoes from like people trusting you because you've built the relationship. Like you don't get time and freedom if clients don't trust you, like across the creative board, right?
Yeah, precisely. If there's no trust in what's going on, yeah, like, and you're being rushed, those are the kind of clients that ultimately you don't want to work with long term. There's a really good meme on social media at the minute. If I find it again, I'll send it to you because it is quite funny. And it's basically, it's client A, budget £500, and it's like, so we'd like the logo 110% bigger, and we want it to be aligned to the left, and you know, we're taking a really big chance on you to do this, and you know, we don't have a lot of budget, blah 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 blah. And then so there's this big spiel, big paragraph, and then it's like option B, which is client £50,000 budget. Yeah, we'll go for option B. And it's like having those, and it isn't about the money, but it's having those clients that are like, we trust you to do what you do, like we're hiring you for that reason, like just go and do what you know works, what we know works, and you know, everyone's going to be happy. It's the ones that are like, you need to do this, and we have to have it in this way. And there's an awful lot of photographers out there who can manage that and who will work really, really well to that. But for me to get out the best stuff, which I know that the clients who love my stuff really, really want, that has to come from time and space. And I know that I've got to get an athlete crossing the finish line, and I know I've got to get some celebration stuff, and I know I need to get X, Y, and Z. But you know, trying to micromanage me too much never gets the best out of me. And the clients that really get that, they're the ones that always end up with the really good stuff, because they just know that's the best way to manage me and let me just go.
I think that works across like creative.
I think it is like a designer, a graphic designer, or a web designer, or you know, a writer who's being pushed in lots and lots of different directions and isn't being allowed to really follow their curiosity when it comes to what they're making, it's never going to do very well. Once you open it up a little bit and just give them the freedom to breathe and take their time, that's when the really good stuff comes out. Like, I would much rather be known when I'm 75 as not as the photographer who's like, oh yeah, he was really solid and like he's got all these consistent photos. Like, I want people to look at my stuff and go, he was an absolute master of what he did. And it, you know, and if you ever watch like martial art films or whatever, the masters that they have, whether it's a master art, no, Michelangelo was not running around like a complete idiot, like ticking off the client briefs as he went. He was just told, go up on the roof and paint this thing or sculpt that. And like the masters of art, the arts, whether that's, you know, sculpture, painted, graphic design, writer, like all those absolute geniuses of what we do that we all look up to, they're not rushing around. They've got lots of time. They're taking lots of time. They know that the best way for them to work is to have freedom and not have too many controls in place. And you know, that's why they're as good as they are. And you work to that point, don't get me wrong. You can't walk into a situation as a rookie creative and go, yeah, well, I need 6 months to do this project, I'm afraid, because I've got to sit with my beret on and smoke cigarettes for 20 hours a day. That's not how it works. But you know, to get that really good stuff, you have to work in that direction.
But you have to, you know, you could have been a photographer. You could be one of the press pen people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, and that's a professional photographer. Or you could be like, and you could go at the end, you could go, I was a professional photographer, and that's what I did with my life. Or you could be, people could remember Ben Lumley, right? Yeah. And just go, Ben Lumley did some flipping epic work, like that guy you mentioned, the F1 work, right? Yeah. You didn't go, F1 takes some beautiful photos.
Nope.
You went, this guy.
And that, I don't feel like that from a, everyone kneel down and worship me because I'm awesome. It's just like, that's the level that I want to be at, because I know that's where the good stuff comes out. And like that mastery of craft is what I'm after all the time. Like, I've literally just come back from a photo shoot this afternoon and there's some really solid stuff in there. But already I'm like, okay, well, next time I get the opportunity and the next time I do this, I'm just going to try this slightly differently. And you know, that light that I had, I'm just going to move a little bit further away because it's kicking too much of a shadow or what. And it's a constant learning process. And as a creative, like, that's what it should be. And interestingly you say about like I could have gone down that professional photographer's route. I call myself a photographer because it's easy for people to understand what I do.
Yeah.
But actually, I know deep down inside, and I'll say it to people, if I know that if the audience that I'm talking to, for example, understand it, then ultimately what I am is a creative and an artist. I'm not a photographer, really. Photography is so pretentious, right? But
it's not pretentious. Photography is just a medium of what you're trying to
write. Which is exactly what I was going to say. It's just the tool that I use to create the stuff that I create. And I am a creative and I am an artist. And it feels weird because I don't have a paintbrush in my hand to call myself an artist, but I use a camera, but I call myself a photographer because 99% of people understand that. If I say, like, in my email signatures, I used to say, oh, I'm a commercial sports photographer. And that used to confuse the crap out of people because I don't do match day photos and I don't take photos of events and then sell them on. Like, I work with sports in a commercial way. I'm thinking banners, branding. Like, you'll notice a lot of my stuff as subject is either left or right. It's very rarely in the center because I'm leaving space for quotes. I'm leaving space for text floated over on a website. I'm always thinking of commercial and commercial stuff like that. So I often refer to myself as like a commercial sports photographer, but people don't understand that. So I usually just say, look, I'm a sports photographer. But yeah, I know deep down that I'm an artist and a creative at heart. That's why I am. I pick a camera up to do it. And it's really easy to tumble into the rabbit hole of, I'll need a £30,000 lens in order to do this. And actually I don't, like, I've battled a lot with that over the winter. Like,
I bet.
Like, do I drop 20 grand on this new lens because I know it would really help? And then I think, actually, do you know what? Like, I do an awful lot of good stuff with the kit I have. I don't need to really upgrade and get anything really snazzy and sexy because I can still do what I do better than anybody else with the kit I've got.
I think you've kind of bought it full circle, which is nice, to the beginning where you go, you know, a creative can't do an elevator pitch, right? You can't go, I'm a sports photographer, but not what you think I am. Because I do the same thing, right? When I'm used to be in a networking room, to people, some people, I just go, I'm in marketing. And they can make whatever mind they want.
Exactly. Yeah, right? And I'll go,
cool. That's exactly the relationship. But for people or things that I care about, right, the explanation is, right, I do this thing. Get a coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you what I do.
Sit and have a chat. Even though I said at the beginning, like, I want 10 pieces of work, there's 10 photos that I'm super proud of, I could still find really hard to pick those. And interestingly, the ones that I would pick would probably not be athletes crossing finishing lines. You know, it wouldn't be anything like that. It's the kind of incidental candid stuff that happens around that sport, the stuff that I'm really, really proud of. It's really hard, I think, for a creative person to sell himself that quickly. And I can't sell myself that quickly. And I've had to build the business relationships that I have had so that clients can see what I can create and how I can work. And it's part of the journey. It's just part of the process you've got to go through with a client. From a business point of view, it's what you have to go through with a client. And yeah. I'm a big proponent of showing off the work you want to get paid for. So from a marketing point of view, I don't show off usually those photos that, you know, 90% of other photographers out there could do. Like, I show off the stuff I want to get paid for because I want clients to go, we want that photo.
Yeah.
We've got Getty and we've got such and such and they can do these. We want that photo. That's what we want. We want that stuff.
But you're absolutely right. And I think it's probably a good place to kind of round off and have the final through is that creative people can't sell themselves and what they do, right? If they're trying to label stuff, right? I think if you're in a flow state of you use, right, or doing something you're passionate about and something you love, work that you're proud of, right? 30 seconds isn't enough words. No,
it's not.
Right? Like, if you're doing stuff you don't care of, you go, oh, I'm a web designer.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it's over, right? In 12 seconds. But it's that
passion.
yeah.
That mastery of craft, that aiming for something that be your legacy, whatever your legacy looks like to you, right? It's that doing that, fulfilling that, ticking that box, following that thread, right? It's a good one. It's a good one.
It's like I know we're in audio land here and nobody can see what I'm about to point out, but you've got a photo, you've got a picture behind your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm guessing it's a painting as opposed to a...
It's my granddad did it, actually.
So it's a piece of art as opposed to a photo, yeah?
Yeah.
Like, that's what I want. I want people to have that stuff of mine framed somewhere. Doesn't necessarily need to be, like, on the side of a building or a billboard. Like, just that legacy for 10 years, 20, 30, 40 years' time to have a print of mine, something that I've shot somewhere that means something to them, that going back to the Bradley Wiggins storybook of pictures, like, enables them to tell that story. Like, that means something to me far more than, like, getting that winning shot and getting it on the BBC or, you know, getting it in the Telegraph. You know, I want it framed. I want it behind someone's head when they're, you know, talking to their grandkids in 40 years' time, and just to have an immense amount of story be able to come out when you look at it and go, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
A creative can then look at something like that and unpack it and realize it isn't a 30-second elevator pitch, that there's a whole lifetime that's gone into making that. And that's why I think creatives who are trying to sell themselves in 30 seconds are always going to struggle, because there's a lifetime of passion and energy and thinking. Like, my brain literally never switches off when I'm working, never switches off. And all creatives are like that. And a fellow creative will understand that. And you can't explain that in 30 seconds.
It's kind of good, though, that some people don't understand it.
Yeah.
That is the good thing of a creative.
100%.
Because, you know, one thing that I've been thinking a lot over the last 10 minutes is good creatives have their own signature. They have their signature style. So when you talk about Michelangelo, he did it in a very certain way.
Yep.
Leonardo, very similar as well. I'm not going to go through all the turtles. But, you know, you'll have a very style. Then somebody will be able to see one of your shots and see a second one and go, oh, Ben did that.
Yeah.
Like, it's about growth of that artistry.
Precisely. So I battled in the first 18 months of launching the business about, like, what's my personal style? What's the look and feel that I wanted to have? And I battled and battled and battled. And eventually, the more I worked and the more I shot, the more it came out. And then I've just kind of found it now. It's become the beast that it is. And it's interesting because, like, we have... So for the first round of Super League, just gone, it's just a good example. I know I keep coming back to netball. It's not the only thing I do. But, like, we had Getty. So we had a Getty photographer and we had me. And even though the work was very, very similar, it was really interesting to see people, like, they'll message me, or a club would message me, or a media rep or a player or a coach would message me and go, that's one of yours, isn't it? Because I want to make sure I credit it to the right person. And the fact that someone who doesn't necessarily know me really well can look at something and go, yeah, Ben took that. That's a Ben Lumley photo. That's not a Getty photo. That's not an AP photo. That's not such and such photo. That's a Ben photo. And I can tell that's Ben's photo because of how it looks.
Yeah.
That's huge. Like, that, whether you write for a living, whether you know, draw, paint, do graphic design, whether you make stuff with your hands, like, that's the dream, is to have that personal style. I mean, and it's an ever evolving, ever changing thing. Like, even today I'm thinking, is my stuff a bit too contrasty? Is it a bit too dark in places? Like, do I need to tweak it? But having that personal style and having that, it's like bonsai trees.
Yeah.
But the art of just, like, clipping a bonsai tree and molding it and, like, keeping it going. And it's not about, like, oh, just give it some water. It's about just shaping it and keeping it alive and keeping it growing. And that's what running a creative business is. It's just that ever constant, like, a little clip in here and a little clip in there, and nudge it in this direction and nudge it in that direction.
And that's why robots will never take over the creative industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
There you go.
That's it.
They'll take over everything else. So
yeah,
if you're pouring water on your bonsai tree, then
that's fine. Yeah, yeah.
You're knackered. But you're never, that whole thing of continually trying to improve because nothing's quite good enough.
Yeah.
Or even if it is good enough, knowing that in 2 years' time you look at it in a different way and go, I could have done it much better.
Yeah. It's so like going back to the Tim was saying about the top-down shots and stuff that I've done from the roof in the last couple of weeks. First time I got one, I was like, that's amazing. I absolutely love it. But now I'm looking at them and going, oh, it's just a little bit soft. It's just a little bit not quite where I want it to be. But that's part of growth. That's part of the creative growth that we all have, whether that's writing with words, you know, writing content for a web page or writing a book or drawing or painting or sculpting or whatever. It's just that constant growth and learning. And that's what leads to mastery. It isn't like, oh, buy this ebook and you're on your way. And it's just, it's understanding that, right, well, this is day one and I'm going to start doing this and it ain't going to end.
No.
Until I stop, it's not ending because it's just a constant thing all the time.
But there's a reason inside art and inside the art vernacular that all those classical painters and sculptors, etc., had one masterpiece.
Yeah.
Because everything else was leading up to that one piece
Absolutely.
Of work.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very similar in what you're describing now. And I find that fascinating because people often go, you know, there's a lot of people who go, my career is marketing or my career is photography or what have you. Actually, it's not. Your career is trying to get to that one thing that you are.
And as an artist, the interesting and exciting thing is, what's that actually going to look like?
You won't know until it's happened. Yeah. You might be dead when people realise that
was
your masterpiece.
Exactly. Like, I might have already created it. Who knows?
Yeah, you but, might
like, the exciting thing is that it's out there somewhere. And if I get to find it, brilliant. If I don't, it's going to be very cool and it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. It's all that pursuit, though, isn't it? That creative pursuit, it's continual improvement. It's, you know, taking that step every day because you don't know. It might get better. It should get better. But Ben, just before we shoot out, we'll put them all in the show notes, everybody, but let people know where best to connect with you or follow your stuff.
See, this is the awkward bit. And I'm like Gary Vee in this sense, is that I hate my social media handle. I really do hate it, but I'm stuck with it. You can find my work primarily is on social media. I'm at Ben Snapstuff, and Ben Snapstuff sounded like a really good idea at the time when I first started, and now I can't stand it. It makes me sound like I take holiday photos for a living. Or my website's benlumleyphoto.co.uk, and that's generally where most people can find me.
I would also echo and put a link into your Creative Mornings talk that you kindly did for us.
Very enjoyable Creative Mornings talk.
And
transit vans for an hour and a half.
Yeah, transit vans with a change in direction, but you'll enjoy it. And your vlog in general is pretty good, so I'm going to put those links in there.
Thank you very much. I do need to do some more vlogging. It's just time and...
It's all right. Mate, you're doing the work. But all right, thanks very much, Ben.
Been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Ben. As a kid, and I was always into photography and graphic design and things like that, and just hear somebody talk about themselves as an artist in photography, just yes.
I know if you've got this far into the podcast, or this is accidentally the first Rear Marketing podcast you've listened to and you think it's a podcast, right, and you wonder why there's a sports photographer guy on it, like, that was the reason why, because he's so much more, right? Spoken every event I've had the pleasure to host, right, I've had Ben speak at, because he's just good. Like, he's full of knowledge and wisdom for someone who's like under 40, and
but passion oozes out of him. That, as marketers and creatives and what have you, what we're always trying to get to is that passion side of things, and man, he's passionate.
But he's got, you know, we covered, just looking down my notes, right, we covered the mastery of craft. We looked at visual communication and stuff like the picture is worth a thousand words. We didn't even get onto how the right imagery for campaigns and stuff, which is technically where we should have done too.
No, I really wanted to get into like perseverance as well, you know, and, you know, how long do you wait to get the right image alongside other things such as his ultra marathon running that he does and how he goes about doing that and if it helps him be more creative. Just there's so much.
He echoed what Michael Owen said in number one of season two about comparison and judgment killing creativity and needing freedom and time. Yeah. We spoke about doing work you're proud of and what it means to be a creative and stop doing shit, stop doing work, do stuff you love. Do you know what, like that urge, that change in perspective we want people to do. Following your passion or purpose, right? We didn't even go on to purpose. I'm sure he's got one.
Yeah, I'm sure he has.
But he's definitely purpose-driven. I just don't, you know, he probably frames it as passion, which is one of the label, which is absolutely fine, right?
I think you and I need to do an episode, just made me think, where we sort of define... the more that we talk about these things, the more the things raise up time and time again. And I'm wondering if we could actually sketch out what a creative person's traits are now. Because it's always been like a grey area of, oh, you're a creative, you're a bit, you're a bit away with the fairies and stuff like that. I think there's some very clear traits coming out for what a creative is.
Well, we did the Ritson's Monster commentary episode.
We did.
About what makes a good marketer.
Marketer, but perhaps we should do one, what makes a good creative.
Yeah, we should. Maybe that will be a bonus episode later in. But that was... but. Like, I urge you, even if you're not into sports or a photographer, right, check out at Ben Snap stuff on Instagram because his shots are beautiful. Like, I have no interest in netball, but, like, I recognise the quality of that work and go, holy shit, that's a good picture, right? And he's just a wise, wise gentleman. I'll put the link to the Creative Mornings talk in there that we've both seen, I think, haven't we? Just moving forward and keep moving forward. But maybe we should get him back on to delve into creativity, not, you know, as a macro topic.
Yeah. It'll be good to have him back on. I think he's just somebody I could listen to all day.
Yeah. Excellent. Good. Yeah. Well, stay tuned, folks. And I hope you're enjoying the season 3. And do all the normal stuff that podcast people do, like share and comment and vote.
Yeah, like and subscribe. That's all I ever hear.
Yeah, all the other stuff. Do all the other stuff that all the other podcast people ask you to. Do that for us. That'd be amazing.
There's no point in remarketing somebody else's spiel. So just do whatever they tell you to do.
Beautiful. Good man. See you later.
Cheers.